Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the marathon bombings happened almost 11 months ago, but still, none of the promised government reviews on what went right and what went wrong in the days before April 15th. We'll discuss with you. Then Jared Bowen says goodbye to Malcolm Rogers and hello to Breaking Bad's Aaron Paul. Then two people who will be marching a mile behind the St. Patrick's Day Parade on Sunday, they join us to tell us why.
Emily Rooney and her world-famous list. Plus, we'll talk about the wild media speculation about the missing Malaysian jetliner. Then our news quiz with Livingston Taylor, great musician, another great musician, Elijah Wald, who also co-wrote the book that was the basis of Inside Llewyn Davis. That's our news quiz. All that's coming up on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
50 degrees tomorrow. I know. Well, all we do is weather. It's
no, it's all you do.
That's all
okay.
I do. So we are closing in on the one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings, and the Globe's Matt Visor in this morning's paper reminds us that we still await the many promised government investigations of what went on before. People like Homeland Security Secretary, actually he's the former head, Tom Ridge, former governor of Pennsylvania, too, and Massachusetts Congressman Bill Keating are taking investigators to task for falling down on the job. At stake are possible intelligence breakdowns and miscues that may have allowed the bombings to take place at all. What we want to know is, does the total lack of government transparency so far, if not stonewalling, trouble you? Does it make you feel less secure? Do you think they're covering something up, or are you perfectly fine with the pace of the disclosures? Our number is 877-301-8970. Before you explode, let me just read Tom Ridge's great quote.
I'm going to explode.
Now, Ridge is not exactly some rabble-rouser. As I say, former governor, former Marine. I don't think you're ever a former Marine. He's a Marine, former governor of my home state of Pennsylvania, and obviously first Homeland Security chief. The delay is unconscionable, he tells Matt Visor in the Globe today. If there was miscommunication or failure to communicate, man up, says Ridge. The tragedy was bad enough to fail to accept there may have been some procedures that were flawed. You want to correct that to make sure you avoid a similar incident in Boston or elsewhere.
What was your question, please? Are they not talking? Are they covering things up because they might have done something wrong?
Yeah, I mean, well, isn't that the sense you get? They're trying to figure out how to spin this story?
You get, believe me, if it were a great performance, the congratulations would have been all around. They would have been months ago. The reason that the government constantly hides behind they don't constantly, but in the instances where they hide behind confidentiality or national security, or it's very rarely either. It is some terrible mishandling of something they don't want you to know about it. And I'm kind of surprised at our own mayor here, Marty Walsh. There was supposed to be this hearing in Boston to look into some of these matters. And he apparently—
A congressional hearing where the congressional committee comes to the scene of the bombing, which is fairly unusual and fairly important.
Joan Vernanke had a piece in the Globe the other day saying that how she understands from a source familiar with the conversation between Marty Walsh and U.S. Representative William Keating, who's been very tough on the lack of transparency here, that Walsh said he didn't want any Republicans traveling to, quote-unquote, my city to bash Obama or the FBI.
He denies that, by the way, for whatever it's worth. He doesn't deny that he spoke to Keating. He says now that I was concerned about the distraction around the time of the marathon. But you know what Keating's response to that is? Have you heard what Keating has had to say?
Keating's
response is terrific. He has a real problem with the hearing not being here. And Keating goes on to say, so let me understand this. People who've lost limbs, who have lost family members, have to travel to Washington to testify. Emergency room physicians have to take a day off and get on a plane to go to Washington to testify when the hearing could have been right here and, I think, done a great public service.
Well, that's exactly what people are going to have to do, survivors of the marathon or anybody involved in the marathon or their families, if our congressional delegation doesn't get its act together and go after opening up cameras in the courtroom because they won't be able to see this trial if there is a trial on television. That's another issue, but that drives me crazy as well.
Our number is 877-301-8970. What's your response to 11 months and virtually no government openness here? And let's just review. The government review that was promised as early as January, they're just putting the finishing touches on it in, quote, a couple of weeks, has not happened. We know that there is a relationship, we've talked a lot about this, to the killing of Ibrahim Todashev, who theoretically in his Orlando apartment last May was about to confess, say the FBI, to having been responsible along with Tamerlan Tsarnaev with the triple murder in Waltham on 9/11 of 2011. And if, in fact, that was true and they had been arrested, obviously there wouldn't have been an April 15th after my former intern, Susan Zalkine, wrote the cover story for Boston Magazine. What happens the next day? The Florida state attorney says he will issue his report by the end of March. But where is the federal report?
When was Todashev killed?
May.
Okay. Have we seen the
autopsy results?
The autopsy results, have we seen those?
The FBI has ordered the medical examiner in Florida not to release him. The only reason we have seen photographs of the body of Todashev, apparently with seven bullets, is because his father got caught. Mm-hmm. A friend of Todashev's took pictures, and his father released him to the press.
Do we know why this young man, and it may be totally justified, but do we know why he was shot multiple times when there were three law enforcement people in that room?
The only thing the FBI said in two brief press releases is, quote, there was a violent confrontation. But as you know, we've heard he had a sword, he had a pole, he had a knife, or that he was unarmed. And let me just add one more thing to the list. The most egregious of all these things, Bill Keating is a member of Congress. When he was with us, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, he mentioned the fact that the FBI had been invited in front of his congressional committee to testify. They said no. Then the chair of the committee invited the FBI to testify in closed-door session. So there's no concern about this being leaked to the public, getting out to the public. What did they say to that?
No. It is staggering.
And the most troubling part of this, to me, at 877-301-8970, is nobody seems to care. Everybody cares about what happened deeply on April 15th. Everybody cares about the three families plus the family of Sean Collier, the 260 people who were injured, some very seriously. But and as Keating has said repeatedly, this is not to point fingers. This is to say if we did something wrong in the lead up to the marathon, then we want to make sure we don't do it again so there's not another marathon-like bombing in the future.
You know, we have asked Governor Deval Patrick this many times when he's been in here, and he's not at all enthusiastic about the idea. In fact, he's rejected calls for Massachusetts with Attorney General Martha Coakley to talk to the state troopers, the Massachusetts state troopers who were down there with the FBI in that room with Todashev, to find out what happened. She's refused it. He's refused it. At one time, actually, Patrick basically said he's a killer, as if Todashev's being allegedly a killer means that there doesn't need to be an investigation. This is part of
Martha Coakley will be with us in the studio on Monday, and we will be sure to bring it up.
This is part of a pattern which, again, I am so surprised that people don't get more upset about, of government lack of transparency and are just saying,
you. Oh,
that's fine. Let them just do whatever they want, and we'll just say, terrific. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. And the thing, again, whether you know you're talking about the NSA stuff or whether you're talking about, I should point out before I even get to that, the whole government-wide transparency thing, that we just went through this trial last summer, the Whitey Bulger trial, which was all about FBI cover-up and corruption, and we still are not at the bottom of that. And that was something that started back in the 70s. So here we have again, and I don't know, we could be wrong. Maybe the FBI did everything right. Maybe they did, but we don't know that. So it's as if we are sitting here allowing the FBI to go rogue, possibly again, and doing nothing.
And by the way, while Ed Davis, former police commissioner of Boston, has said, has recanted to a degree what he originally said to Congress, when he was asked if he was alerted to any of the information that the federal authorities had on the elder Tsarnaev's trips, did he know about them? Was a chair with them in this joint terrorism task force? The answer was no. And he said to Congress, after having said, well, essentially it's no big deal later, he said, had he been given the information, he would have followed up. What does that mean? It means before April 15th of last year, the Boston police would have visited the Tsarnaev household on Norfolk Street in Cambridge. Who knows what would have happened? And as Keating, as Congressman Keating has said on our show, again, this is not about recriminations. This is about finding out what was done right and wrong so that if there are other Tsarnaev brothers out there, assuming they're responsible, and I think virtually all of us think they are, that we prevent the next Boston Marathon bombing. 877-301-8970.
And one last thing before we get to the calls. As we have said here before, and you said it too, that we still don't know what investigation, the length and breadth of the investigation into the Waltham triple murders, the three guys that were involved in some marijuana dealing that were viciously slain, almost decapitated. We don't know the complete role of the Waltham police. We don't know the complete role of the state police in Massachusetts. We don't know the complete role of the district attorney's office. We don't know how thoroughly that was investigated, whether, which is my theory, and I could be mistaken, but that when it's drug dealers, we don't get the same intensity of the investigation you might if it were just, you know, Mr. and Mrs. James Smith that lived in some lovely house with a white picket fence, or if they did everything as they should have. But again, if they did everything...
Well, we know they didn't do everything as they should have because, as we said the other day, several of the friends of one of the dead men, Brendan Mess, mentioned that his best friend, this is one of the dead men in Waltham, was Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And did the police visit Tamerlan Tsarnaev? The answer is no. So there are a million holes here.
The bottom line here is when the government doesn't tell you what happened, it's 99% of the time because the government doesn't want you to know because they didn't do what they should have.
Well, in the words of Tom Ridge, man up. If there was miscommunication or failure to communicate, man up. I am totally with Tom Ridge. 877-301-8970. Does this matter to you? Does it make you feel less secure? Are you offended, as I know Bill Keating was? He's a member of Congress and can't get answers. We are just normal people, and obviously we can't get them either. Let's start in Dedham, where Sean is on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Sean.
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Guys, you know, this is a long that we go without answers to the investigation. This opens up itself up to questions. The longer every day that goes by that we don't have answers and they're not giving us answers, we have to start to wonder, what are they holding back? And this should be priority one, not only to all of Boston, but to the whole country. I mean, they hit us at this marathon. What's next? New York City Marathon? Pick a big World Series, Super Bowl. We've got to get information, spread it around to different authorities and let people know what they could be doing, what they're planning. And if the communication between different departments in the whole country, the FBI and the local police isn't there, we're doomed.
Hey, by the way, I want you to know, Sean, I've known you through the radio for years. I've never compared you to a sitting congressman, but I'm about to do that. This is exactly what Bill Keating has said. Let's just get the information, use it in a prospective way to make sure it keeps us safe. Sean, it's great to talk to you. Enjoy the weekend. What?
I'm thinking about running for some political office. Can I expect you to give me a sizable check to get me going?
All I can say to you is thanks so much for the call, Sean. Talk to you soon. 877-301-8970. And by the way, it is not unreasonable to assume, you've said this twice already, so let me echo what you're saying, what Sean said as well. The longer there is not disclosure, and specifically since the feds have said they finished one of their investigations and they expected to release it, this is early January, within, quote, 2 weeks, and it's a lot more, it's more than 2 months after the fact, is they're trying to figure out how to explain away whatever may not have been done according to the letter of their regulations and law.
We just got an email from Susan from Assonet who says, last Saturday, This American Life did an outstanding presentation of this very topic. I sat in my car for half an hour, unable to tear myself away.
That was Susan Salkind. Yeah.
Yeah, she's referring to Susan Salkind, who wrote the piece for Boston Magazine, who was also your former intern and was on your TV show the other night. And I'm so glad Susan mentioned this because one of the things that Salkind talked about in This American Life thing, and she may have mentioned in Boston Magazine too, I'm not sure, but that Tardashev, and he of course was the friend of Tamerlan Tsarnaev that was killed in Florida for reasons we still don't know anything about. His girlfriend has been deported. He had a friend who was questioned repeatedly by the FBI, and the same friend was pulled over by law enforcement for having an expired license. And you know what happened to him for an expired license?
I do.
He went to jail for having an expired license, and then he was deported. So,
you know why she was? Why Tatiana, the girlfriend of Tardashev, you know why they told her she was being deported? You know what the reason was, and they confirmed this?
What's that?
She had spoken to a reporter.
That's right.
From Boston
Magazine. That's right.
Magazine.
She's spoken to her. So I don't want to get carried away here, but you know, this is United States of America. This is not supposed to happen here, and we still have no explanation. Who gets sent to jail for an expired driver's license? Do you know anybody, Jim?
Well, I know that guy. Well, I don't know him, but I know of him. 877-301 8970. Let's go to Brockton, where Michael is on Boston Public Radio. Michael, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, hi. You know, you had mentioned, you know, this lack of transparency with the government. I mean, look at Benghazi. I mean, the media is like, Benghazi who? You know, oh, the one where our first diplomat in so many decades got killed, that Benghazi? I mean, I think it's certainly a factor is you have a liberal administration and you have a liberal media.
Well, for whatever it's worth, Michael, let me say to you that I think most people would say if there's a slant to the Boston Globe, it's liberal. The Boston Globe has been relentless in terms of the lack of transparency on the government vis-a-vis what happened in Orlando and what happened on April 15th. And by the way, Brian McGrory, the editor of the Globe, with whom we speak every Wednesday, has echoed those things. So you may see Benghazi as purely Fox News pursuing the story, and you may have some legitimacy there, but I think the so-called liberal media, at least in this town, has been relentless on this issue.
I would argue we know a lot more.
Sorry,
what they choose. You know, they're selective, though, in what they choose. I mean, I haven't seen them go after anything that would really damage the government. I mean, no one still knows what happened in Benghazi. I mean,
well, we hear you, but for whatever it's worth, the FBI right now reports to the President of the United States, who most people, and I assume you too, Michael, would consider to be a liberal, whom most of the press mm-hmm. likes, and I think they've been fairly relentless in their pursuit. But we hear you, and we accept your point of view.
My take on it.
No, we appreciate your call. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to do it. 877-301-8970.
I just want to say something to Michael, that Glenn Doherty, one of the Navy SEALs that was killed over in Benghazi, his sister said to me in an interview a few weeks ago that she wished there was less focusing on what happened, you know, and we do know a lot about Benghazi. I would argue we know more about Benghazi than we do about certain aspects of this whole situation in Boston. But it's taken the focus away, the blaming, the pointing fingers, has taken away the focus from trying to catch anybody. She said she would like to have her brother's killers brought to justice.
Yeah, but who's in great part at fault since the caller raised Benghazi? Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's comment to Congress out of frustration
about who cares,
it was a serious misstep and disrespectful for someone I otherwise admire, but I think that was it basically fed red meat to those who believe there's a cover-up.
It's going to haunt her if she does run for president. I think it definitely will. It's going to haunt her all during the campaign season if she does indeed run. Let's go to James on the South Shore. Hi, James.
Hello, James.
Hello and good day, and thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
It's a very important topic and really needs to be explored.
Is that it?
Oh, is that it? We agree with you. You are concise and to the...
My concern is today that Catherine, Chamberlain's wife, has really not been brought to the forefront. If I were the investigator, she would be first on my list, and I would... question her relentlessly.
Well, you don't. In all truth, James, we don't know if they've got an. I don't know. We don't know if they have an agenda there. And one of the reasons they haven't charged her with anything is because they are pursuing her, because they are trailing her, because they're hoping she makes contacts. I don't know what the answer is. You're suggesting, and you may be right, they've totally cleared her, which might be troubling, but we really don't know what the backstory is.
Although I often thought, James, since she was working about 80 hours a week, that she may have been. Actually unaware of what was going on there. I mean, she was out of the apartment for much of the day, every single day, while she's supporting him, while he's at home making bombs, you know?
Certainly plausible.
Yeah.
I also think that given the fact or given the video that they were coming around the corner there at the whiskey on Boylston Street, the woman with the yellow balloons just in front of them, and why we haven't been able to get down to the bottom of that, and is it possible that woman with the yellow balloons was Catherine?
I have not heard that theory before, but maybe someone else will email us or tweet us.
And those balloons could have been a signal in that the bombs were not telephone controlled, they were radio.
We hear you. James, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. My most serious concern here is your concern, Marjorie. which is that we end up being patsies in almost all these things. The reason Bill Keating can't get answers is not because he hasn't been relentless. It's because we're not relentless. We move on. Everybody, as I said, cares deeply about the families who suffered through this. That day is going to be emblazoned in our souls and minds forever. But there's no follow-up. There's no follow-up.
Well, what's really scary, I think, is that when you think that the full weight and power of the United States government could suddenly come down on your back when you haven't, when you're not a bad person. And that's what's scary about this, these things happen in isolated circumstances. And since 9/11, you know, we think, well, you know, it's national security. Well, it's an anti-terrorism thing. Well, it's this. Well, it's that. And they've gone overboard, if you
ask
me.
Well, let's stay with Totashev for a second. How much would, unless they produce a report that suggests the FBI agent had no choice but to shoot this guy 7 times to protect. And by the way, if you read Susan Zalkind's piece, Totashev was a scary character.
Explosive.
There's no question about it. I mean, a really scary character.
It may be totally justified.
So let us know that it was totally justified. And if it isn't totally justified, I would like to have him alive and being questioned so we can find out publicly if, in fact, he and the elder Tsarnaev did commit this triple murder and whether or not the police, the law enforcement people, did a enough of a good job post 9/11 to try to capture the killers.
Speaking of 9/11, at the bottom of Jovanovic's story about all this covering up of things, she mentioned that Congressman Stephen Lynch and Republican Representative Walter Jones of North Carolina both called upon the Obama administration to declassify information about 9/11. You know, 9/11 obviously happened a long time ago, and we still don't have all the information there. And they're once again claiming it has to do with security reasons. Well, maybe it does, but I think the
Lynch has read the 28 pages, he said, and the 28 pages that are not being released, he as a member of Congress has said he sees nothing that would compromise national security. And by the way, if they've got to redact some parts of it, then they do that. But the err on the side of release,
well,
I think the general.
I think they have an obligation to convince the public that they're not just covering up terrible things and getting away with it.
And by the way, one of the ways that you can have an effect on this is, while we said Bill Keating has been relentless, and you just mentioned what Steve Lynch is doing, call your member of Congress and say you'd like to urge them to urge federal officials to do their jobs. And by the way, the one downside is, even if they do their jobs, we've mentioned this before, Charlie Savage, who used to work at the Globe and now is the New York Times, did a great piece about 6 months ago in the New York Times in which he looked at, I think it's the last 10 years, I'm not sure, of FBI internal investigations of their own agents who have shot and or killed someone they were questioning. And in 150 out of 150 cases, the FBI has cleared their agent, which suggests that even if they do ever release an investigation of what happened in that apartment in Orlando, it may not be enlightening, which I would suggest should cause Congress or somebody else to call for some sort of independent investigation.
I mean,
to satisfy the public demand, assuming there is a public demand.
What did the families of Whitey Bulger's victims all say after the trial?
What was that?
We still haven't gotten to the bottom of this government corruption.
Well,
we still
a lot of them said the
happened.
FBI people should have been the ones sitting there with Whitey Bulger as defendants in the case. Jesse, you're in Norwood. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Jesse.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
Hey, I heard this American Life piece, and the takeaway that I got from it is that first of all, Totashev told his friends that he was afraid that the FBI was going to pin this on him, that he was going to get framed for it. I don't know whether he was guilty or not, but he did express to friends that he felt that he was being, you know, railroaded and that they were going to try to hang this on him.
Right, that's what the girlfriend, Tatiana, told Susan Zalkind, and she reported in her story. That's correct,
right,
Jesse.
Right. And during the investigation, and so we know that he had a temper, during the investigation during which he was interviewed by the FBI over a period of months, they kept at him. And then in the final fatal interview, it was reported by Susan Zalkind that one of the troopers passed the FBI guy a note saying, "Hey, I think this guy is going to snap."
He may have texted him, I think, but he did communicate with him in some fashion.
Yeah, you're right. It was a text saying, "You know, I think you're pushing this guy too far, basically." And let's imagine being in that room with the FBI interviewer, just pushing this guy, saying, "You were there, you were there, you were there, you did this, you did this," and him just seeing the noose, you know, seeing it closing around his neck and just freaking out and seeing the handwriting on the wall was that these guys are going to make him pay for it.
Yeah, but yeah, Jesse, you know what the response of a number of people who have far more expertise in this area than I to that issue, which would suggest in that environment it may have been totally appropriate what the FBI did, is the response I've read repeatedly is, why were they questioning someone at such a critical time who is so dangerous and has such a hairpin trigger in his own apartment? Why were they not? I mean, you know, they had interviewed him a number of times, you know, from Zalkind's story. Why, right, in that critical moment when they're apparently about to get him to sign a confession, why would they be doing it in his apartment rather than in a set? And we don't even know, by the way, and I know you know this, Jesse, we don't even know who was in the room. Were the troopers from Massachusetts in the room? Was the Orlando cop in the room? Was it just the FBI agent? We know nothing. For those who haven't seen it, and Jesse, thanks for a fine call. If you Google the FBI press releases, there are one short paragraph press releases released, I think it was May 22nd, he was killed shortly after that, which tell you absolutely nothing except that there, as I say, was a, quote, violent confrontation, yeah, in the apartment.
The bottom line is they don't feel they have any obligation to tell anything at all to the American people that they don't want the American people to know.
Because I mean, the American people don't demand it. That's why they feel there's no obligation.
We don't demand it. If we put pressure on our congresspeople, on our state representatives, it would change. While we're at it, we should put pressure on our congresspeople to make sure that the trial, if there is a trial, of the Marathon bomber is open and on television so that people who have suffered tremendously do not have to physically go to the courthouse in South Boston to watch the trial.
Well, excuse me. I haven't suffered tremendously. I want to watch the trial.
Everybody wants
to watch the trial.
The younger
Tsarnaev is being prosecuted in my name, the United States,
yes,
of America, versus Zhar Tsarnaev.
You know,
I want to
else?
See the prosecution.
You know something else? Even if you do physically go to the trial, you know who's taking up most of the seats in that courtroom?
I do know.
People that work at the courthouse.
I know.
I mean, it's all, you know, it's like an inside deal. It just drives you crazy. At least it drives me crazy. Anyway, up next, I need to calm down here. Jared Bowen is going to join us for an overview of the local art scene. Stay tuned for that conversation with Jared, 89.7 WGBH. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
Join some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
Innovation requires people clustering. This is the basic mechanism of economic growth.
I'm Kara Miller, the places where innovation grows. This week on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Pop Money, available at Citizens Bank, a service where users can send, request, and receive money with an email address or smartphone. Information at popmoney.com or citizensbank.com. And the Baker Library Bloomberg Center at Harvard Business School, now exhibiting the art of American advertising with ads, trade cards, and catalogs from the dawn of modern advertising. Info at library.hbs.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And here with us in Studio 3 to lighten things up a little bit, to go over the latest on the stage and silver screen as GBH Arts Editor, that would be Jared Bowen. Jared is also the host of the TV show Open Studio. Hello there, Jared.
Hi there. Good afternoon.
How are you? Well, I saw your great piece on television on Emily's show about Malcolm Rogers, the director of the MFA, retiring. Tell people who don't know, he did some really wacky things. Remember the big car exhibit that was there? He had all those snazzy...
Ralph Lauren. I went to
it. Yes. Tell people about some of the unusual things he did.
Well, first of all, my father went to the Ralph Lauren car show. I can't get my father to go anywhere, but he went there. And that was Malcolm Rogers' whole intent. We're already talking about it like he's in the past tense when really he's staying on for a couple more years until they find a replacement. But he wanted to get people into that museum who had not been into the museum before. And he did that through the car shows like Ralph Lauren, which he did because he wanted to change people's sensibility about cars and refine their aesthetic sensibility. He put the collection of Bill Koch in the museum, which he got a lot of controversy about because
America's Cup deal, right?
It landed two yachts on the front yard of the MFA, perhaps a little bit crass. But at the same time, what people are not talking about is Bill Koch actually has a fabulous art collection, and so much of that was in the MFA. He had, you know, he has collected some of the greatest European painters. So Malcolm Rogers just wanted to change programming and get all new audiences in the MFA.
Can we just listen to a tiny little piece of Jared's interview with the outgoing MFA director, Malcolm Rogers?
I like change. That's certainly the case. To some extent, I like being seen as radical. I said somewhere the other day, no one likes criticism, but I don't make my decisions on the basis of whether they will be popular or not.
Well, you know, to me, this is what was really fantastic about Malcolm Rogers, because the MFA in certain circles, you know, people think, oh, it's very snooty, it's, you know, Picasso and Impressionist. But then you can bring in people that would never go. As you mentioned, I brought my kids to see those cars, and you could they open them up and you could see the inside seats and the whole thing. I think you could even sit in one of them, as I recall. So this was a way to kind of democratize, I guess, the MFA.
Well, the term that's been used a lot for him is populist. He will be known as the populist director at the MFA. And depending on who is using the term, I think it's also a disparaging term, that accusing him of dumbing down the MFA. And he's often been accused of that, especially by other major museum directors around the country, museum directors who have a much greater endowment so they can afford to risk more and not necessarily have to be concerned about what the actual ticket sales bring in. But what Malcolm Rogers did is he took an institution, and this predates my coverage, but an institution that was perceived as very inaccessible.
Literally and figuratively.
Exactly. Because of the front doors were not even open. And it was the Dowager of Huntington Avenue is how he described it to me. And he has brought so much vitality to that museum. Jim, as you just mentioned, people can now literally enter the front doors, which is quite significant. They can come in through the Fenway entrance. He has established that great Art of the Americas wing, which is just gleaming, and it's a beautiful collection. It's one of the preeminent collections of American art in this country. They have great parties. They have great spaces. They have great programming. You go there, and unlike a lot of art institutions in this region, speaking of all performing arts and the art museums, you see younger audience. You see lots of kids in there. So it has a vitality that it did not have before.
You know, for those cynical types like me, who when someone leaves a post like that, the first thing they say, oh, he was fired. In fact, this guy was offered a long-term contract about a year or so ago, and he just decided he didn't want to do it, correct?
Yeah, he told me that it was really mathematics, that he's 65 years old, he's got to figure out how he's going to spend the next 15 years of his life. I don't know why 80 is suddenly the cutoff, but he's really thinking about this time and what he wants to do. I did ask him, because I'm a journalist, I'm cynical too. I said, were you forced out? He said, no, absolutely not. And he was confident they would have continued to extend his contract.
You know, I don't want to obsess on this Ralph Lauren thing, but Marjorie doesn't remember. Do you know why you went? It wasn't to take your kids, even though you did take your kids.
I don't remember.
We had Malcolm Rogers on the radio because he wanted to, in our old incarnation, because he wanted to promote Ralph Lauren.
That's right.
I said for days, I said, I cannot believe that I'm going to a Ralph Lauren car show at the MFA. Totally loved it. I went because I had to, not because I wanted to. I loved it. And as it worked exactly as he hoped. I've gone to the MFA so many times more since that time than I went in the 10 years before because it was sort of back in the mix with it, which is exactly what Rogers' agenda
and
was,
the great
right?
Fashion. Didn't he do the Herberts thing? Wasn't that a big deal with him?
That was his sort of opening salvo. That was the thing that got him in so much trouble.
The fashion photography.
Exactly, because people thought, why would you be throwing up pictures of Jack Nicholson as a Joker up on museum walls? People just didn't get it. And that's when he really started to signal change, and there actually started to be a conversation about the museum.
Right.
I mean, for me, the Ralph Lauren car legacy is the fact that I have not bought a car since without thinking about the design. And that's exactly what he wanted.
That's great. That's great.
There are missteps, too. I think most recently it was Mario Testino, which perhaps has links back to Herberts. Mario Testino is a great contemporary photographer, the likes of Annie Leibovitz. You know, he photographs people who are in Vogue and all the fashion magazines, Vanity Fair. And I know it turned off a lot of museum patrons and even some board members who thought it was somewhat pornographic and just had no place on the museum walls because it was a little too commercial, a little too crass. But you've got to try things out. You have to put things out there and see how it's going to land. And sometimes you take risks and they don't always succeed.
Speaking of commercial, will you consider it low rent if I end the discussion about Malcolm Rogers by saying, and I love the gift shop too?
It is
one of
great.
The truly
the
great
gift
museum great. Gift shops.
And you know, you can have a nice little meal there as well. It's, you feel very, I don't know.
Well, you can in the cafe. I was just going to say something. I don't enjoy the upstairs restaurant, but yeah. I think the cafe
well, the
is
food
great.
Is food is not great in the upstairs restaurant.
No,
but the cafe is
and you
very
leave hungry.
Nice.
That's my problem with it.
Teeny tiny portions.
At Bravo, you can't. Yeah, you have to go home and have a snack after.
So we're all going low rent. Okay, I've waited long enough for this. For those of us who are suffering from Breaking Bad withdrawal, which is any intelligent American, I should say, at least the lesser half, and I don't want to mean to upset anybody, Aaron Paul. Is in a movie, and here is a little piece from the need. It's actually from the trailer for The Need for Speed.
That's my boy.
Yo, T, I'm really happy you're home.
Boys, we miss you, brother.
It's time to celebrate.
Call up some females. Do you know any pretty ones?
You like your mama?
What are you thinking, Toby?
This could put him away for life. It's time we make him pay. But first, we're gonna need a fast car.
Y'all ready?
We're doing this.
Jesse Pinkman is back. That's his character for the few of you who didn't watch Breaking Bad. How's the movie? What's it about, a video game or something?
It's based on a video game, so I have not played the video game, and I've never seen Breaking Bad, which I think you know. And
I didn't want to talk
I
about it,
I swear, by August 31st, I assure you, I will at least watch half of it. Probably most of it.
I don't think
half
of it is enough, but that's fine.
And
okay.
In seeing Aaron Paul in this performance makes me want to see it because he's really good.
Is he really good in this?
He's really good. Yeah. So this is based on a video game. And essentially what happens, he plays this guy named Toby Marshall who's really good at restoring cars. And it tries to evoke the great car movies of the 60s and 70s. In fact, they have one scene at a drive-in where you see Steve McQueen racing through the hills of San Francisco.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh,
so
neat.
They try to conjure that. And in some ways, it is that type of movie for... you know, 2014. It doesn't quite have the integrity because there's a lot of CGI graphics and this movie is in 3D, but he plays somebody who's restoring cars. He's wrongly imprisoned, gets out of prison, and essentially has to race his arch nemesis by driving across country and participating in this unsanctioned Grand Prix in California that's presided over by the Monarch, who's played by Michael Keaton. And it's so fantastic to see Michael Keaton back on the screen because he's just great. But I have to say, as these kinds of movies go, and you know, you're not putting it up there with Gravity or 12 Years a Slave. It's kind of a fun movie as you see them driving across country. There's this fabulous scene that takes them through Monument Valley in Utah. And one of the most preposterous things that could possibly happen, which I loved every second of, the way that they're sort of rescued at one point involving a helicopter. It's just this crazy caper car movie that I thought was largely fun.
By the way, the look of terror on Jared's face when he mentioned Gravity and was worried I was going to do my Sandra Bullock imitation yet again. I will not. Once is... absolutely.
Do you know
funny.
How many parties that's gotten me through since the last time I was on by recreating your porn / Sandra Bullock impersonation?
Porn. It was the Harry Met Sally most famous scene recreated right here in Studio 3. So what about this 300 deal? Tell people about that.
Well, this is another one. First of all, I think you have to put yourself in the frame of mind of what kind of movies you're getting in March.
Bad ones?
Not great ones, shall we say. But this movie I largely enjoyed, too. This is sort of a parallel film to 300, which came out a number of years ago, and it's based on a graphic novel, and it's just hugely stylized. It's all effects. You can tell that most of the film was shot in front of a green screen. But this catapults us back into Greek times where you have the Persians being fended off by the Greeks, and this Themistocles has this great army and he's got to go up against the Persian army and their 1,000 ships, and everything is operatic, and you have this leader that he's trying to fight, a Persian leader, Artemisia, who... basically envelops Themistocles in great sex and power struggles and interplay. And it's all this Greek tragedy told through a 2014 prism of computer-generated graphics. I have to say, it's horrifically violent. I mean, I actually saw...
Oh, Marjorie's kind of movie.
Yeah, I won't go.
What's that?
I saw a woman leave the screening muttering to herself about a half hour in, because it especially if you see it in 3D, of all this blood coming at you and limbs, and at one point she decapitates somebody and lifts her head up and kisses the head. I mean, it's just...
On True Detective, I'm fine with that. But when it comes to the 300 series, I'm not...
You know, do we have to have it so in your face? Can't we just do a little implied violence? You know,
check
I mean?
Out a video game when you have a couple of minutes, which sell far more than any movie in our time sells.
About it, if you ask me.
I don't get it. And where do you go from here? I mean, this is
a very good point. To snuff films is what you do.
Pretty much, because I don't know how you could... of course, you always say that. How could it be worse? But they'll find a way to make it worse.
Okay. We're going to go from the screen to the stage. Do you want to start with Chekhov?
Of course, why not? Nice and
where's the Huntington?
Refreshing. it's the Seagull. It just started playing at the Huntington. They had their opening night Wednesday night. I was there, and of course, this is a classic Chekhov play about a group of artists who are gathering at a country estate, and the days are long and they're hot, and they're just exchanging these ideas about art, but they're all falling in love with each other, and it all centers around Madame Arkadyevna, who's this great big flourish actress who comes in with a flourish. She wants everybody to fawn over her. The one person who needs to be fawned over is her son, Constantine, often dejected. And so it's classic Russian story of interplay, mislove, connections. Because it's Chekhov, a lot of it is implied. A lot happens offstage. So you're just sort of seeing life in a rather naturalistic way. But the interesting story here is actually the story behind the story, which is Kate Burton from TV Scandal. She plays Sally Langston, the villainous vice president. Sorry, I've binge watching that because I was interviewing her. And she is playing alongside her real-life son, Morgan Ritchie, in some great Freudian break that has to happen to depict this relationship.
Now, Jared, I bet you did not know that when he was in high school, there was a certain person in the room had a starring role in The Seagull. Maybe you could recreate a line or two.
I had one line. I don't know if it was a starring line. I don't know if it's in this particular
Well, if you had one line, it was
adaption.
Not a starring role.
My line was, "The gull is mine." Is that in this particular production or no?
No, it's not.
You know, I think you just erased any memory of performances. You were so good. I can't possibly remember.
It's a true story.
You want to say that again? You want to say that again, Jim?
The gull is mine.
Oh,
that
my
was
God.
I don't know what accent I was trying to do, but that is true. I did perform.
That's
so
spectacular.
To speak,
okay.
How is it, by the way?
It's okay. Here's the deal. Chekhov described it as a comedy, and they mine a lot of the comedy in this piece, but I think not in the most appropriate ways, because this is a piece that, while sort of funny at the onset, veers into the darkness of the human condition, especially when it comes to love and how we want to be love and what we give other people. And I don't feel that the tone I've always appreciated for the piece necessarily came through in this production.
Do you have a problem? I mean, we had a discussion with the great Frank Rich about a decade ago on the radio about, you know, obviously his first, before he became the great political writer,
yeah,
is
the
Butcher of Broadway.
Yeah, the Butcher of Broadway.
Where when he was the stage critic, one bad review in the New York Times from Frank Rich could shut down a multi-million dollar play. And we asked him, and I can't remember his answer, about how bad he felt when he wrote an honest, bad review and when he knew what the consequences would be. When you had, let's call it equivocal review, how do you feel about that? I mean, when you think about all the person hours that are put into something, how do you deal with that kind of thing? It's one, you know, a movie is one thing, but I'm talking about particularly plays or art exhibits or that sort of thing. How do you feel about that?
I mean, it's funny. I've never been asked that question, but I'll tell you very truthfully that I think it does factor in, especially in this town where there are so few people talking about the arts. I think I have to be so responsible in what I'm saying. I also have to be very mindful that I'm the only that I'm just one person bringing an opinion to this. I will say it's a little more well-informed, hopefully, because I'm doing all of my research and I care so deeply. But I want to be mindful that I was just talking about this yesterday. There's no malfeasance in this town when it comes to the arts. People, they work so hard. They endeavor so hard. And I don't think that anybody's just putting something on the stage or on a museum wall or at the ballet just to do it. Everybody cares so deeply about what they're doing. Sometimes it goes awry. And I'm also mindful that audiences have only a limited number of dollars, and I don't want them to misspend them if it's really not worth it. But I do take all of that into consideration.
But you know what? If someone like myself, who's just a lay person that doesn't know, like you do, a lot about the arts, I can't think of a time I've ever gone to see something in Boston that I haven't come away and thought, wow, I should do this more often. You know, the production was great.
You're talking about the stage, live productions.
Live productions,
well, it's so exciting to just be at a live production.
Yeah, I mean, we really have incredibly talented people right here in the city. And not everything is a fortune either. You know, some of these Broadway productions that come through, they're very, very expensive. I remember I was complaining about Once. It was, you know, $85 for a ticket basically on the roof of the theater.
I saw it in New York. Forget $85.
Yeah, okay. In New York, it's even more expensive. But you can go to things, you know, like the American Repertoire Theater in Cambridge and be practically in the front row for $65.
Yeah, even less. I mean, people don't realize that all of the theaters that I cover have some sort of different pricing structure. They'll have a pay what you can night, or you know, discounted tickets here or there, or if you get there early enough, you can start at $25. I think the ART has $25 tickets. Like anything in life, if you pay less, you'll get less.
Right.
You might have a somewhat obstructive view or be toward the back, or you may have to work a little bit harder to get that ticket. But everything that I cover has some limited cost ticket.
Let me just say, I've said it on the air before, I sat ninth row center at All the Way, the great Bryan Cranston LBJ play at the ART for $25 a ticket.
Wow.
And I mean, it is staggering. It's really, it's great and accessible.
That's a great, great place for people who haven't been there. And the theater's very small, and you're never very far from the stage.
By the way, we just got a note that because of your review, the Seagull closed this afternoon. I don't want you to feel bad.
People should see. I mean, it's worth it to see Kate Burton. She's Richard Burton's daughter, by the way.
I know that, yes. So before you go, the flick. I hadn't heard much about it. What's the deal here?
It's a new play, and actually this is the one I really, really loved. This you find three young people, probably in their early 20s, late 20s, working in a movie theater.
Set in Central Mass, right.
In a Worcester County old movie theater. You look up, you see the tiles are falling down in the movie theater. It's, you know, that last movie theater you went to before stadium seating.
Yes.
and ordering Pinot Grigio and whatever at your seat.
I love that.
And you have these three who come together, and in a way it is like The Seagull, because Annie Baker is a very young playwright, and she depicts people very naturalistically. There's no great dramatic arc that happens. There's no explosion in terms of what they're doing, but you understand who these characters are and how they relate to one another. There's one line in this piece, speaking of your Seagull line, that will stick with me forever. One character turns to another, and he says, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And the character turns back to him, and he says, "I am a grown-up." And it just hits you in your stomach.
It hit me when you just said it.
Yeah.
I
will think about that for the rest of my life.
That's right. We all are grown-ups in this room, tragically or not, as the case may be.
Sure, that's a great line.
So I can't suggest seeing this piece enough, because you really get the sense of all these characters. And I left the theater not only thinking about that line, but wondering about them, how they continue to interact, and just concerned about them, which is a great thing to be able to say about a piece.
Before you go, what's the thing that's coming up in the next week or so you're most excited about?
God, you always ask me that. I'm seeing The Whale on Sunday at Speakeasy Stage Company, which sounds fascinating.
About the 600-pound guy.
Yep.
Yeah. That's something more people should see, because I think you'll come away, talk about empathy for the characters, empathy for him.
Yeah, and when has theater ever gone to a place like that? Of course, you see deformed figures and whatnot in plays like The Elephant Man, but this sounds very, very interesting.
He has that whole suit. Yeah. He wears this whole huge suit to make him look like it looks a little weird, though, because he's got this huge body and this little teeny tiny head. You know? And if he were really 600 pounds, his head would be bigger, too. But
listen to this review, or this pre-review from Marjorie.
If they didn't offer those cheap tickets, they could pay for the prosthetics to have him have a big head.
You know, like, he needs more of a chipmunk look, I think, to really be complete. But in any case,
great to see you,
it looks fascinating.
Thanks, that was great.
Jared Bowen, thank you as always for being here. Jared Bowen is WGBH's arts editor and host of the TV show Studio, which you can catch tonight and every Friday night at 8:30. Jared, thanks again.
Open Studio.
I said that, didn't I?
You did? I don't know.
I didn't. It's open studio.
And actually, we're off the air right now. We come back next Friday.
Okay, so we're not going to see you tonight. Yeah. Forget about it.
So it's
don't
fine
watch
to get it wrong.
Don't
it doesn't
watch
matter.
It tonight. Jim, what would I do if you weren't here to correct me every 2 seconds?
Actually, one of our producers corrected me, so it's okay.
Okay, up next, we're going to talk to two people who are walking in the alternative St. Patrick's Day parade. The meaning of being at the back of a backwards Boston tradition is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Oh.
On Campus is WGBH's higher ed desk.
Obama asked college presidents to make new commitments to help more young people go to and graduate from college.
There is this huge cohort of talent that we're not tapping.
At the White House, many schools vowed to contact high-achieving, low-income students directly and to encourage them to apply.
Listen for reports from Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Museum of Science, where you can step inside the Hall of Human Life and exhibit you and discover how everyday human behavior affects our brains, our bodies, and the world around us. Details at mos.org/exhibit you. And the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, striving to provide patients with expert cancer care, innovative services, and treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 are two people who were working around the controversial, non-inclusive St. Patrick's Day Parade. That'd be Pat Scanlon. Pat's a Vietnam veteran, leader of the Boston chapter of Veterans for Peace. Tina Cherry is president and CEO of the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute. Tina, Pat, good to see you both. Thanks so much
for
coming.
Thank you for having us. Very much so.
Thank you for coming in. So the parade is happening Sunday. Everybody knows there's been a big controversy about gay veterans and gay anybody marching openly, identifying themselves as being gay. I think people get what the controversy is there. Wacko Hurley and the Allied War veterans don't want them to be open. But I don't get, Pat Scanlon, what your problem is. You represent the Veterans for Peace. Yes. You're a Vietnam veteran. Yes. Many of your members highly decorated. What's your problem? How come you don't
Born on St. Patrick's Day, by the way.
Is that true?
Really?
That's true.
Happy
That's
almost
true.
Birthday.
Yeah, almost. Almost. I don't understand. The first time that I was involved, now this goes back to 2003, as mm-hmm. you know, and because you were involved with Tony way back then.
Yeah, Tony Flaherty, yes. Another Veteran for Peace.
Right. And 4 years ago, we innocently, you know, as the new coordinator, I was a coordinator, I've been coordinator for 5 years, I submitted an application to the Allied War Veterans Council. And in that application, I said, we just want to walk with our flags and our banners, and we have these other banners. One says, bring the troops home, take care of them when they get here. And the other one said, peace is patriotic, not a dirty word. But I also said, if any of the things that we'd be carrying are objectionable, you know, we'd be willing to, you know, you'd tell us. We didn't get anything right. I called Phil Winsky, the parade organizer, and he said, you guys have been denied. And I said, did they say anything as to why we were denied? That's what he said. They did not want to have the word peace associated with the word veteran. And I said to him, that's not just not a name. That's our organization. We're a national veterans organization. I said, I have over 200 vets, many of which highly decorated combat vets in my chapter. And we can't walk because we have peace in our name. He goes, well, you guys are too political. I said, let me get this straight. We're talking about the St. Patrick's Day Parade, where all the politicians get together in the morning and have their breakfast and tell their jokes. And this is the parade that all the politicians who can walk are walking in the parade, and those who can't ride in the parade. This is the parade that has military formations and bands and trucks and tanks and junior ROTC from one end of the parade to the other. But none of that is political. But we are because we have peace in our name. Is that? And he said, all I can do is refer you to the decision. Of course, we know that's the Hurley decision. I said, thank you.
United States Supreme Court decision.
Right. I said, thank you. And I went back to my folks and I said, look, I have a lot of LGBT friends. And I said, no one has pushed this envelope for 17 years. And every year it's the same thing. And so we decided to pull our permit and have our first parade. So the first year, we only had 3 weeks by the time they said we could have a permit. We had 500 people, one band, and a duck boat. Thank God for the duck boat people. They are so supportive of us. And last year, we had 8 divisions, 6 bands, 1 duck boat, 2 trolleys, some floats, and 2,500 participants in 8 different divisions, you know, that were – and so – and we're continuing just to say – we are open. We are inclusive. We are welcoming. Bring your signs. Bring your shirts for the LGBT community. Bring your shirt that says I'm Irish, gay, and proud. You know, and we are welcoming of to everyone.
We're going to talk about the mechanics and the logistics of the parade in a minute, but I have to say, when Marjorie and I were discussing Veterans for Peace about, I don't know, 2 weeks ago when you started writing about this year's parade, and I said, why are they not allowed to march? And she said what you just said, and I thought she was kidding when she first said it, but apparently not. Now, Tina Cherry, who Marjorie and I have known for a long time, the head of the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, why are you not marching in the front parade? Why are you marching with Pat and his friends and colleagues, Tina?
Well, we've never marched in the front parade because we didn't feel that we belong there.
Why?
Because it didn't speak to us. It's focusing South Boston and Irish. And, you know, I'm not Irish. And
Linda Dorsina-Forey is not Irish either, and she's leading the breakfast.
Well, that's history, yes. Yeah. So I try to go to that breakfast. I got an invitation, but by the time I called, it was filled up.
Hey, I can take care of you.
That is history there.
But go ahead, I'm sorry.
So for us, that you know, it just didn't feel like we, mm-hmm. you know, like we belong there. Again, grassroots organization, you know, that works with families impacted by murder. It somehow just didn't seem that we fit.
And we should say, we know the story, and obviously a lot of people may not, even though they should. Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, which you run, is named after your son. And you should explain to people why this institute was created. What happened to Lewis D. Brown?
Well, he was shot and killed 20 years ago, December 20th, 1993. And Lewis really wanted to be the first black president, but he couldn't understand that how adults were always blaming young people in urban setting for the problem.
What was he doing on the day that he was shot and
killed? He was going to a Christmas party for a group that he belonged to called the Teens Against Gang Violence. And he was actually caught in a crossfire. And I often tell people it was the day that he was killed that I woke up, that I realized that we cannot continue to blame young people and we cannot continue to allow certain part of our community to be known as hotspots and continue to play that game. So it was truly his death that woke me up. And the message for peace I wanted to push forth, I wanted to teach the value of peace through literature and community service learning. We didn't want to focus on the ongoing problem. We wanted to show that peace is possible, especially in urban settings. And we've been doing that for the past 20 years.
By the way, she was called in the Globe, one of my favorite expressions, and I don't think this offends you, a wedding planner for funerals. And while it seems odd, and I think you take it in the right spirit, what was said is you work with virtually all the families who lose someone they love to gun violence in terms of they haven't dealt with the press. How do you celebrate the life of the person you love rather than only talking about how he or she died? And we're going to talk about a rally and march you have in May on Mother's Day that is one of the great events that Boston has. Pat, what are the rules for when Marjorie? Another thing she told me that I couldn't believe, so I'll verify with you. Do you start a mile behind, or what's the deal?
Back in 2003, some of our members, before the bombing started in Iraq, walked behind the street sweepers. The police at that time said, why don't you walk in front of the street sweepers? You know, they didn't want to, they were getting dust blown up in their faces. And it proved how right they were, you know, protesting that war before it even started. The Allied War Veterans Council, which they referred to themselves as the War Council, but they sued the city of Boston. And it went into Judge Collins and federal court, and it was ruled that, okay, if there's going to be two parades on the street, you have to be a mile apart. You don't have to be, but it'd be a mile apart. So they could let us a lot closer to that parade, but that is a ruling. And so that's where the mile comes in.
So do people say, we know that there are tons and tons of people watching the St. Patrick's Day parade. You start a mile behind. Are people of South Boston and beyond still on the sides of the street when you and your colleagues come through?
For the past 3 years, the street sweepers have been behind the first parade. Mm-hmm. And not only just a street sweeper. Last year, we counted them. There were 12 street sweepers plus other vehicles and people with brooms and everything else. It's a whole company of people walking down the street, cleaning the streets. That tells you the parade is over. You know, there's a First Amendment issue here because the city, by doing that, kind of supports the message of the first parade and diminishes the message of the second parade. So who's left on the streets? There aren't the hundreds of thousands, but there are the tens of thousands. Now, this year, we just had a meeting with the police on Tuesday. The street sweepers are going to be behind us. Mm. The barriers are going to stay up, and they are going to keep us as close to that mile as they possibly can. And so I think that goes to Superintendent Bernie O'Rourke and Deputy Superintendent Bill Ridge and the mayor in making that happen this year. And so we anticipate that there will be a lot of people still in the streets, more than the tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands of people, you know, to see our messages of peace.
And what's the interaction like with veterans who are not members of your organization, who are marching that day, and afterwards you're at a bar or you're on the street or whatever? What's the feeling back and forth?
When we tell them the story, I'm a member of Vietnam Veterans of America. I'm a member of Veterans of Foreign War. And if I'm in a place and we're talking and we explain to them what the situation is, it's overwhelmingly in support of us. Like, how can this possibly be? How can this possibly be?
I mean, even if they don't or are not bought into your message, I assume your position is you, of course,
it's
have a right to march.
It's just not right.
Is this your first year, Tina Cherry, to be marching in this parade? Have you marched before?
Yes, this is our first year. We've always gotten an invitation from Pat, but something always happened. And then this year, Melida, her and Carlos are being the
Arredondo.
They're being the grand marshal, and Melida invited us to walk. And one of the things we're doing, we're not only walking at the Peace Institute, there's a peace collaborative. So it's a lot of peace organizations in the city that are participating and walking with a banner, Peace Collaborative, incorporating a message that peace is possible. Because we want to show the inner city peace work front and center. And we feel that this is a great opportunity to connect with this peace parade.
You know, we should know, just say, most people only know Carlos Arredondo from the iconic photograph when he's with Jeff Bauman saving his life, obviously, on the marathon day, the man in the cowboy hat. For those who don't know Carlos, who obviously one of his sons was killed in Iraq and another son hanged himself in subsequent years, he and Melita have been relentless peace activists for years and years. And one of the things that I had him on TV a couple of weeks ago, one of the things they said was the beauty of his role in the marathon, beyond the fact that he saved a life, is at least a life. Is that it's gotten a lot more attention to the work they've been doing for years and years, money, people, that sort of thing. So honoring them as your marshals is great.
Yeah, they've been longtime members of Veterans for Peace in our chapter for a long time.
You know, it is, when you think about it, a really weird picture. In the front, you have the Allied War Veterans Parade, and there are bands, and there are people in uniform and so forth. And then you have this gap, and then you have the parade in the back, the back of the parade. It's just, there's something very...
With the great music.
With great music. But I mean, it doesn't reflect well on the city of Boston.
You invite Marty Walsh, I think we'd all agree, has been nothing short of relentless and powerful in terms of this gay and lesbian inclusion thing. Yes. I know I've read that you, Pat, your organization has invited both he and Congressman Lynch, who's also been a key player in trying to get this parade. Are they marching with you? Have you gotten a response, or do you not know?
No, we haven't gotten a response.
Know.
We wrote a letter to all the senators and the reps and the U.S. reps and U.S. senators and all the candidates. And one of the things that we have heard is that the vast majority, almost 99% of them, are not walking in the first parade. So that's fine. You don't have to walk in our parade, but make a statement. Like Sam Adams has made a statement. Another statement that's been made are the Friel sisters. There are three wonderful, talented women musicians from Ireland that are coming. And they have shunned the first parade, and because they've heard what was going on, and they are going to be in our parade. They're going to be performing in our parade.
Really?
Yes. And so in talking with them, Donegal, that's where they're coming from. All of Ireland All their parades, all their celebrations are open to everyone. There's no exclusion of anyone.
And by the way, let me just say, if you're going to praise Sam Adams, which is fine, we should also praise Club Cafe in the South End,
yes,
which said yesterday that if Sam Adams continues to, yes, sponsor the parade, they will no longer sell Sam Adams beer. Mm. And lo and behold, 24 hours later, they decided to drop out.
And I should point out, as late as yesterday afternoon, Sam Adams was staying in, and then they did an about-face after the Club Cafe said they would stop selling
Sam
Adams beer.
So if people want to learn about your parade, Pat Scanlon, or participate, how do they get the information? Where does it start?
They can
go to
our website, smedleyvfp.org, to peaceparade.org.
Wait, peaceparade.org?
Yeah. And let me just tell you quickly. We have eight divisions. There's veterans. There's peace. There's religious. Then there's LGBT. There's environmental. There's political. There's labor. And there's social and economic justice. So if people are interested in peace, if they are peaceful and in word and action and deeds and signs, and but if they are concerned about one of those issues, they are welcome to come with themselves, with their group, and join our parade.
And
that's our rules.
And what time are you gathering? What time are you gathering?
We gather at 2 o'clock. It's on D Street, so D and West Broadway. And D Street will be forming up, and that's where we step off from.
Peaceparade.org. And we only have a minute left. Tina Cherry, just as an advance, we're going to have you back before Mother's Day, but tell people who don't know what you do in a minute, if you can, on Mother's Day.
On Mother's Day, we come together, and we really provide a space where, again, as community, we are celebrating Mother's Day and also providing a space where all those who want to encourage and engage in peace are providing can be there on that day. And we have last year over 10,000 people that participated from all across Massachusetts. And it's also our only major fundraiser. And our goal is to raise $200,000.
And we should say, because Tina runs a great, what street are you on? Down, what street is it on that your place is at?
Dorchester Avenue.
Dorchester Avenue, which I've been to. You want a wonderful office there where kids can come, moms can come, people who've lost a loved one through violence and get help coping with this. And as Jim said before, getting help, getting through the initial days, dealing with the media, dealing with the police, preparing for the funeral, and helping mothers who can't afford it get money to bury their sons. And it usually is sons.
Tina Cherry, Pat Scanlon, good luck with your work. And it's
thank
great
you
to see you both. Thanks
great
so much for spending
thank
some
you
time
thank
with
you
us.
Thank
you're
you
welcome
very
to come on.
We're going to do our best, actually. We were talking about just this morning. Thank you, Pat, for the invite.
Thank you.
Coming up, Emily Rooney. She is here on Open Mic, as she is every single Friday here on Boston Public Radio. Don't go away.
Hey there, Edgar B. Herwick III here from the WGBH Curiosity Desk. Now, we've all heard that sea levels are rising, but scientists say that here in Boston, they're rising 4 times faster than the global average. So what does that mean for us? Join me and some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Limited tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Innuendo in Natick celebrating the Hunter Douglas Energy Smart Style Window Fashions event featuring Hunter Douglas Duet Arcatella Energy Efficient Shades along with Silhouette and Luminette Shading Systems. Innuendo.com. And Basic Black, the region's sharpest observers of current events, discuss the latest topics impacting African American communities. Don't miss Basic Black. Tonight at 7:30 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Emily Rooney joins us every Friday for Open Mic. And, of course, you can keep up with her weeknights on Greater Boston at 7 o'clock on Channel 2. And tonight on Beat the Press, my favorite episode. Who's going to be on that show with you again?
Let's see.
Oh, yes.
Marjorie.
My colleague, Marjorie Egan.
That's right. I'm
going to
be on Beat the Press tonight with Emily. I'm very excited. Looking forward to it. But we are obsessed with this whole lack of transparency surrounding the marathon. We talked about it for 20 minutes at the top of the show. You are as well.
Yes,
what is
I
your
am.
Any particular area of obsession or just the whole thing?
You know, actually, I was a little surprised when I read that whole thing about Tom Ridge this morning.
Yes.
About the – I didn't realize, excuse my ignorance, that there was – we were awaiting a federal report. I've been awaiting – some local reports about what went down the night in Watertown when the shooting and this discovery of the Zarniah brothers. I didn't realize we were waiting for – did you?
No, I did not, actually. I didn't either. So
well,
you're not the only one.
Well, Bill Keating has told us – let me read, if you just tuned in, the great quote from Tom Ridge, who, as I said, is not exactly a rabble-rouser.
No, no.
Former head of Homeland Security in Today's Globe by Matt Visor. The delay is unconscionable. If there was miscommunication or failure to communicate, man up. The tragedy was bad enough to fail to accept there may have been some procedures that were flawed. You want to correct that to make sure you avoid a similar incident in Boston or elsewhere. Isn't that
but
the response of any
same about?
Well, there are a couple of reports. One, the feds theoretically were doing some report. The Homeland Security Committee that Bill Keating sits on has been attempting to do some support, but as you well know, the FBI, at least up until a few months ago, has refused to even testify in closed-door session on that.
No,
and I think they're focusing on is not what happened starting April 15th, but on the run-up to April 15th, for example, did federal law enforcement officials share adequate information about what they knew about Tamerlan Tsarnaev's trips overseas with Ed Davis,
example? But security at the actual site, that's a stretch. I mean, there was, believe me, I was down there. There was security that day. So some failure to communicate security. And could they have caught the Tsarnaev brothers well before the marathon because, of course, the triple murder in Waltham, which –
allegedly told a chef in the older.
They should have figured that out.
So I just want to ask you a quick question here, Emily. You've been a reporter a long time, so am I. When the government fails to tell you the details of something that went down, what do you suspect the reason is?
Something they did wrong, and they don't
exactly
want you to know about it. I mean, what is this? Is not a mystery.
Exactly. So they're covering up errors here.
And we're never going to get the truth. We're certainly not going to get the truth about the Tsarnaev brothers. I mean, about what happened with Ibrahim Todashev. We're never going to get
that. But Congress can't even get the truth. I said this earlier
it's
today.
It's just horrible.
It is, you don't expect, this is a horribly cynical comment, but no more cynical than your comment, is that we're not going to get the truth. One would assume that when you have Bill Keating, an elected member of Congress, say that the FBI has rejected the request of a duly elected committee of Congress to appear in closed-door session, how dysfunctional is this government. They won't even tell people who are elected representatives what happened, much less the general public, which does feed the notion, or at least should feed the notion, as you said, that there's much more there.
It's scary.
There.
Yeah.
Well, another thing that I'm getting scared that we may not know about for quite some time is this terrible disappearance of this Malaysian Airlines jet. We're talking on Beat the Press
we are.
Tonight about that, but also about sort of this crazy speculation what has happened to it.
I just read the script that we're working on for this, and I hadn't even heard some of this speculation, you know, that a meteor hit it. And I mean the stuff that has come out in the media is, I mean, one of the problems is this is a genuine mystery. So I mean, I think it's okay to kind of come up with some possibilities. Stop clock is right twice a day. I mean, one of these theories is going to be right. It's either going to be terrorism or a wayward pilot, or something's going to end up being right. But
it's become almost a game.
I mean,
people on cable TV late at night make sure, I assume their producers say in the ear, make sure your hopes and prayers are with the victims.
Yeah.
You have to say that, and then you show a couple of pictures of a family member who's very upset. This is all a game at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if there aren't 239 missing people. Where do you think it is?
I know.
Is it the bottom of the Indian Ocean? Did they land in the jungle like Lost? Last night, Piers Morgan. I watched the whole thing. First half of the show was experts who I thought were pretty informative. I learned a lot. The second half of the show was three people whose sole function was they were invited to speculate. He literally said the word speculate. And then when Patrick Smith, who we've had on from Ask the Pilot, had the temerity to say, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't think it's that useful to speculate. Piers Morgan, his head almost popped
off. Get the hook. Drag him out of here.
But you know what he said? I mean, in defense of Piers Morgan, who's about to lose his job, so I want to be kind to him. In defense of Piers Morgan, he was so taken aback by Patrick Smith. What he said to him, and I'm paraphrasing, and this has some legitimacy, is the reason we speculate, he didn't say the truth, is because the audience wants it, is because maybe someone's going to say something in a completely unsolved mystery that may cause someone who's got some authority and brains to say, aha, I hadn't thought of that. Maybe we should pursue that avenue.
No.
Well, whatever.
I mean, well, you know, you had...
She turned it off. That's why she's trying to humiliate
Emily
me.
Emily Rooney, you had the best guy
Dave
I've
Gallo.
Seen on your show.
He's been all over CNN, too.
He's been all over CNN.
Who's this? The Woods Hole guy?
Yeah.
He is good.
Who
but,
was behind the discovery of the Air France flight that went down.
But tell people how long the Air France flight was missing.
It was a month.
I thought it was longer than that.
No, a month. And it took 2 years to get it.
Okay.
But it was missing a month.
Missing for a month.
Yeah.
So this could go on for quite some time, and we really have
At least they knew where that was. They knew the general area where it had gone down. This, I mean, can you imagine? You know, you're 1 minute you're in the Atlantic, the next minute you're in the Indian Ocean. I mean, it's like...
Well, you know, also, the one... I was going to say plus. It's a horrible thing to say when there are 239 people who probably lost their lives. I've learned a lot from this. You know, I asked all the same stupid questions that everybody is asking. Well, wait a second. If you can find a cell phone when you lose it, why can't you find a plane? Did you know that when a plane goes 100 to 150 miles offshore, there's no more radar
coverage? I didn't know that either.
I didn't know anything about that.
I didn't either.
And so there, we've learned a bunch of technological things, but they're disturbing is what they are. The notion that something this size could have been in the air for, 4 to 5 additional hours after their GPSs, the two GPS transponder, whatever it is, went off. And no one saw anything? No machinery or technology picked up anything?
What about that oil rigger who says he saw something?
Oh, the airplane in flames. Yeah. You know, but one of our colleagues said this morning, Amanda actually said it this morning, and it was a great point. We have become transfixed by this, and it is a mystery, and we don't know what happened. But the Ukraine is sort of like just totally gone off.
They have elections, she mentioned, in Crimea. I know. It's
Venezuela.
Yeah, forget that. We want to know about this airplane. So it's just
you know, one this is a horrible thing to say, too, but one positive, if I may say that, has been this coordination with the world. I mean, India, China, Malaysia, us. I mean, I think it's a fascination in France and Italy. I mean, people
you could not have been more wrong. All we do on these shows is trash every other country's incompetence.
No.
Malaysians, they're morons. The Chinese, they don't disclose. No, I didn't say you said it. I'm saying. I didn't say you said it.
Who said that? Piers Morgan?
Piers Morgan.
just lost his
I'm sorry. Well, I'm a big Anderson Cooper
Patrick
fan.
Patrick Smith didn't
say
it.
No, a lot of people are suggesting... Well,
by the way, the fact that they've changed that 10 o'clock show on CNN that used to be Anderson Cooper's and it's gone, I adored it. Now they have some weird
And by the way, the lead producer was our friend Jack Gray, who was
terrible.
Fabulous.
But they canceled Anderson 360?
They canceled his 10 o'clock thing.
The 10 o'clock
the
show.
The panel where they sit around.
Now I have nothing to watch at 10 o'clock. I'm very distraught. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the St. Patrick's Day Parade. Yeah. We just had Pat Scanlon in here, who's with the Veterans for Peace, and of course they're banned from the parade because they dare to mention the words peace in a parade. And we should point out that many of his members have got medals all over the place from their bravery in Vietnam and Korea, went overseas and fought and so forth.
Excuse me, what was the Secretary of State's organization? What did he found with my friend Chris Gregory?
Vietnam
Veterans for Peace. For peace, against the war. No, against the war, you're right, I'm sorry.
Anyway, the Vietnam Veterans, that's a very good point. So they're banned, and Tina Cherry, who represents the Lewis Brown Peace Institute in Dorchester, she's walking with him. But what has been rather encouraging, I must say, except for your station, which is broadcasting this whole thing. I don't mean to criticize your station,
okay,
Jim, but it's broadcasting this whole thing as if it's a carnival, as if there isn't any at least they say they're not, but the ads would indicate that they are. Other companies are dropping out. We just had this morning Sam Adams, who has done a complete 180 about face. Jammin', the radio station, has done a complete 180 about face. Our old employer, Greater Media. Hot 96.9.
In part because, by the way, the first person to talk about the corporate sponsors and participants, I should say, because you're more humble than at least I am, was you in the Boston Herald.
Jim, you haven't let me talk yet, but
everyone is more humble.
It's probably going to shock you. I'm not necessarily on board with this.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, I don't think it was altruism, the reason why Sam Adams pulled out.
No, it's money.
Yeah, because other bars and stuff were saying they're not going to sell his product.
Right.
That's why they pulled out. And I have to say this about the organizers of the parade. They're consistent. They have been consistent for the last 30 or 40 years or however long this thing has been going on. no advocacy groups can march in the parade. That includes anybody with any kind of signage that isn't.
This is why I love Emily Ruin. Okay, Emily.
That's consistent. Hold on for a second.
Who gets to go first?
I do.
Go ahead.
For a change. How about this? I would say rather disgraceful Catholic priest who's been trashing everybody and saying horrible things about homosexuality. He's an advocacy group.
He's not going to be marching with a sign.
His band is.
But he's not marching with signage. That's my point. Everybody who is in that parade, you won't know what their advocacy issue is because they don't have a sign.
It's a very warlike parade. You've been there.
No, it's a veterans parade. That's supposedly. I don't understand the whole thing. I don't know why anybody would go. Believe me.
What's wrong with the veterans for peace? They're advocating peace.
Because that's outrageous. They can march. They just can't carry a sign.
With the name of their organization?
They can't carry the sign.
They can't sign the sign Veterans for Peace?
They can't carry a sign.
What if an organization...
That's the whole point.
Emily, what if an organization of blacks was barred from the parade because they believe in social... It's blacks,
no,
African-Americans
no.
for social justice.
They would be allowed to march if they
without
didn't
their
carry
sign.
Signage. Everybody
okay.
can march.
So you can march if you're black as long as you don't say I'm African-American.
Well, no.
I mean,
no,
that's kind of ridiculous.
They could say I'm African-American, I suppose, but...
But I don't believe in anything.
Here's the problem with this, Emily. It's the point of view of the signage. That's the issue.
Wacko
Hurley is 84 years old. He has had a death grip on this march for all this time. And in his defense, the Supreme Court did rule, and we all know that. You can have anybody you want to have in a parade.
You can block them.
That's right. The world has changed dramatically. And I blame for this situation other veterans groups, frankly, that don't put pressure on this war veterans group to say, hey, you know what? We're veterans, too, and we disagree with you. I don't know why they have been so silent about this. The only people that are complaining are the Veterans for Peace. The world has moved. This is an embarrassment for Boston.
I don't disagree. I'm just like taking the point of view that this has been consistent through the decades,
and this is
the rule which the Supreme Court ruled on, that they're following.
But you're saying that because you know, bigotry is consistent for 30 years, we should say it's fine.
Constitutionally protected, too.
They're saying that they can march. They're saying you are welcome to march. They have said that to mass equality. You just can't carry signage.
Okay.
So they're not excluding them.
I just got a note from Emily's producer. You are not on Beat the Press tonight, Marjorie. Sorry, but you'll have free time.
Okay.
Here's what
Let's move on after this incredibly tense couple of minutes here.
Here it is.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. We just had it. Okay, Emily Rooney, I ask you this every week, and I always hope the answer is yes. Is it thematic? Yes or no?
It is. This week is
thematic. What is it?
We love themes. Marjorie, you'll be fine. I just need to remind you, Jim, that this is my list.
Yeah,
it's
Emily's
list.
That means be quiet, Jim.
No. I don't want you amending it as I go.
Okay.
All right? Because he's going to be desperate to amend this one.
Okay.
This is a list of my good attributes and bad attributes.
Oh boy.
You're going to want to get right into this, aren't you?
We love this.
All right. It's going to go in order, good, bad. All right, so here's a good one. I get over disappointment easily. I move right on.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, I've had some terrible things happen to me, which is, grief is different. But disappointment over things, you know, you didn't win this or you lost that or this, I move right on. I can't even remember. It happens very quickly. However, here's a bad one. I am extremely easily annoyed. I mean, just like, instantly annoyed.
You're kidding.
I never would have guessed.
You're
not allowed to say anything.
Okay,
so for instance, I play tennis and pentaball almost every day with a group. They can't keep score. It drives me out of my mind. It's just, am I the only one who can keep score? The answer is yes. And it's just, I find it so annoying. I know, I gotta comment.
You know what's really
that
annoying
one.
That I can't comment on this
yeah,
list?
Exactly.
That is what is annoying. Go ahead.
All right, another good quality. I don't experience jealousy. I don't even know what the emotion is. I people have laughed at me. I don't know what it is. I mean, have I, you know, wished I looked like Gisele Bündchen or something for a day?
Yeah, we've all done
but
that.
But I don't really have that emotion.
Like if I've lost a boyfriend to somebody, I'm not mad at the woman.
Good quality.
I know it's a good one.
How come she can comment on these and I can't comment?
How'd you get to that place?
I think I was just born with it. I'm just lucky because, I mean, it's not that I've never been jilted or anything like that, but I'm not jealous about the other woman.
Yeah.
I'm always annoyed at the guy. I mean, whatever.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
But
it's not jealousy.
Okay. All right. Here's a bad one. I'm revengeful.
My father
used to say...
You're not jealous, but you kill him.
My father had a great line. He said,
He said, revenge is a very satisfying emotion. Even if you just kind of play it out in your head.
Yeah.
You know, but
it's great.
I'm definitely
so
revengeful.
I am with you. Go ahead.
All right, here's a good quality. I'm extremely...
By the way, I think since you're always correcting you and Marjorie, I believe it's vengeful. You're not revengeful. You're vengeful.
Vengeful.
You?
You're right.
Thank you.
After the show, you can tell Emily some of your plots and the things that you've done.
Vengeful.
That's all I can say.
Revenge is an emotion. Yeah, vengeful. That's what I am. All right. So here's a good quality. I'm generous with my money. I think I got this from my father, too. It's just like, I don't worry about what I spend. I don't feel like I'm going to be richer if I don't give money away or I don't spend money and stuff. I just don't worry about it. It's not that I have a ton of it. I just feel like I'm generous. I am generous.
Hmm. Remember that day?
Go ahead.
About her shopping spree.
You want to know what I paid for this jacket?
I'm not going to go on.
I'm less generous with my time. I in fact, this is horrible, but like when people invite me to birthday celebrations for women and that kind of thing, I am not going.
This is unbelievable.
Just no. The answer is, in fact, people are embarrassed when they won't invite me because they know the answer is no. I'm not going.
Now, hold on. May I just ask you a question?
Yeah. Don't
so if you
question.
Do go to a birthday celebration.
Oh, she's a joy at one of those things, I'm sure.
Do you leave after 15 minutes?
15 minutes. That's the reason why I don't show.
Okay.
It's like, you don't want me there.
Okay,
you
know? Next.
All right. I'm doing this in a reverse order. This is bad quality. I guess it could be either. I'm highly competitive. Hmm. Oh, what a shock, right, Jim?
I'm not saying anything, so why would I care? Go ahead.
But here's the good part. I rarely care who wins. Even though I'm really competitive about it. And I mean, even when I'm playing or I'm watching some team or another. I'm good with whoever wins.
Wow.
All right, finally. I do have thick skin. I can take the criticism. I really can. I hear it. I listen to it. I'm not crushed by it. However, the bad quality is I cannot resist a zippy response.
Yeah.
Firing back emails.
That's not a bad quality. That's a great quality.
Gotta do it.
Am I allowed to speak now?
Yeah, you can speak.
So what motivated you? I know when you decide what you're going to do on Emily's list, I know she actually puts, I know this for a fact, decent amount of work in this. What caused you to decide, I'm going to publicly disclose my sense of self, my good and my bad qualities? What caused you to do that?
You know, I started last week because I had true confessions last week.
It was great.
And I started working on another list for this week that isn't true confessions, but it was things that I wish were true. I'm still working on that list.
Good.
So I started working on a bunch of lists together. And so I've settled on this one. But there are others like this to come.
Oh,
things I wish that were true.
Last week when Emily's true confessions, one of her true confessions was that when she ate a banana, she put the peel in the basket.
Somebody else's wastebasket.
All over the newsroom this week, you know, people have been
checking their
wastebaskets. Depositing their banana peels with a shout-out to Emily's list. I mean,
I know. I had somebody stop me in the hallway and say that she does that, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I like the smell of bananas.
Okay. Fine.
Not after they've been peeled.
How do you feel about the smell of bananas,
I really don't care.
He didn't even know why.
No.
I would move it to somebody else.
Why?
Because you don't eat bananas, but the smell is overbearing because worse as the day goes on. Alan knows, right?
Fruit flies.
Thank you,
Alan.
Fruit flies. Hate those.
Emily, you have a show tonight with Marjorie. What are you doing exactly?
Well, we are going to do ridiculous speculation and theories that have been, all over the news this week about the Malaysian Airlines flight. And then I'm doing a thing about Joe McGinnis, the writer who died.
Yes.
A little bit more nuanced. It's not an obituary, but it's looking back at his legacy, which was, he was one of the finest nuanced writers of our time. But he never got past that accusation that he had betrayed a source. That was the Jeffrey McDonald case where he befriended this guy who was convicted of murdering his wife and two young daughters. And Jeffrey McDonald thought that Joe McGinnis was going to fall on his side and say, the guy has to be innocent, but he didn't. And so a lot was written about how he betrayed the source. And so
and Janet Malcolm wrote a devastating piece about his supposed betrayal.
The journalist and the murderer.
Yes, and it was in The New Yorker, became a book.
Turned out she had done the same thing, though, to one of her subjects.
She had, and we can talk about this on your show tonight, but she had a really horrible quote about reporters.
Yeah, I'm going to use it.
but basically saying that a reporter is constantly selling somebody out.
Yeah.
And I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, you may do that with a politician, but if you're interviewing someone who's a regular citizen who happens to be in some horrible news story, I don't think that is true at all.
Hmm. Well, I think she's saying when you want your subject to like you, and so you're beguiling in a sense, but really you know what you're going to say about them in the end.
Yeah, well, I think she has a very jaundiced view. I'm glad I was never interviewed by her. Is she still alive?
Yeah, she's 80 years old. Okay. I had to check that out myself.
Okay, well, I will be Emily,
not be
great
to see you.
All right.
Fabulous
can't check
list.
My list for next week.
Really yeah. good.
And then I'm on vacation the week after.
Oh, no. So
you're going to cancel the whole show. So I can't even start.
Oh, no. Yeah. Fridays won't be the same, Emily, without you.
See you tonight,
okay.
Emily.
Emily does join us every Friday for Open Mic, and you can catch up with her weeknights in Greater Boston. It's on 7 o'clock every night, and on Friday nights, it's Beat the Press. I'm there with Emily tonight and a bunch of other people. It's going to be lots of fun. Up next, it's our Friday news quiz with two musicians, Livingston Taylor and Elijah Wall. Time to crank up your radio. They're next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Extra half century is no detail to a philosopher.
You can't simply add 50 years or 80 years to our lifespan and think you're just going to plop that into life as we know it and everything else stays the same.
Yale philosopher Shelley Kagan on humanity's new paradigm when humans live longer. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And Olin College of Engineering, sponsor of Innovation Hub, heard Thursdays and Saturdays on WGBH. Olin, where a focus on the needs of people in the real world ignites passion and innovation. More at olin.edu. And M.F. Reynolds, builder since 1890, craftsman and construction manager specialized in residential remodeling projects and historic renovation in Boston and the surrounding areas. Details at mfreynolds.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Regan. It's time for our weekly news quiz. Today, I should say we will be joined by two renowned and local musicians. One is here now. The other one, we're told, is parking his car. The one who is here is one of my favorite people, actually. Livingston Taylor is a singer. No, you are. I love you.
Oh, Jimmy. You treat me good, lad. St. Patty's Day.
Okay, that's right.
Is a singer-songwriter who's given us more than 15 albums. He's also a professor at Berklee College of Music. His latest CD, which I am dying for, coming out next month in April, it is called Blue Sky. Hello, Liv Taylor.
Thank you, Jim. Nice to see you, Marjorie.
Nice to
always
see you,
a
too.
Pleasure.
Very happy you're here.
Thank
we
you.
Have a missing guest, but we're
he'll
hoping
be here.
He's
he'll be here in a couple of seconds. Seconds.
But you know,
tell us about the new CD.
Yeah,
oh, I'm sorry.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Tell us about the new CD.
Well, I recorded it in a fistful of places, did a couple of things around Boston, up in North Andover and down in Westwood.
Oh.
And then I took those completed things and I went into an apartment with a friend, with a former student of mine, young fella named Charlie Puth. And he's 21 years old and he has these lovely musical sensibilities. And I went into the studio and Charlie and I worked for a bunch. But after all, he is 21. And anybody who thinks that I'm putting my hands in the career of a 21-year-old is simply high on medical marijuana. So,
is that Puth is his name?
What?
Puth is
Puth.
The lad's
Charlie
name?
Puth. Puth. Okay,
got it. Got it.
And he's so I packed up Charlie, and we headed down south to Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, fun.
And I worked with a fellow down there by the name of Mac McAnally, Mississippi fella who works with Jimmy Buffett, who's an old friend of mine, and so Mac has had the full infrastructure, and twist this, turn that. Sing this note, play that one,
and Blue and Sky emerges.
Write a fistful of checks, and now we're good to go.
Okay, enough small talk, Livingston Taylor. While we're waiting for Elijah Wall to come, would you be so kind as to play us? I'm assuming this may appear on this new CD.
Yeah,
is that
let's
correct?
See what we have on this new song.
Do you tie the bow tie yourself,
see.
Or is that a snap-on? You would never just sign. No, he's offended that I even asked the question.
Oh, you cut me to the quick. Of course. You know, I was born
tying bow ties.
In a tuxedo, having tied a bow tie.
I bet you were. Please. I take it back. I feel bad about the whole thing.
I'm always intrigued by this notion of, I love Katharine Hepburn's line in African Queen, "Human nature, Mr. Allnut, is what we're here to rise above." Yeah, it's just this notion that's for some reason the pedestrian behavior of the great unwashed masses is to be emulated and enthusiastically pursued. I don't think so.
I didn't think so. What's the name of the song, Livingston Taylor?
I haven't decided what I'm going to play yet. How about that for Untogether? No, this is a song written by a woman. I'm sort of stalling for time as I tune this guitar slightly. Let's go down by the grapevine, drink my daddy's wine. Good morning. Down by the grapevine, drink my daddy's wine. Good morning. Morning. Blindness, a little magic, a little kindness, oh sweet blindness, all over me. Four leaves on a clover, why I'm just a bit of a shade hung over. Come on, baby, do a slow float. You're a good-looking river boat. Ain't that sweet, that blindness good to me? Oh, ain't that sweet, that blindness good to me? Now, this is a song written by a woman by the name of Laura Nero.
Heard her.
So, yeah, she was, I was driving along in my car, and I heard a version of this by the Fifth Dimension. And it was nice, but it was bouncy. And those lyrics had a pathos in them that I just couldn't avoid. When she'd sing, please don't tell my mother that I'm a saloon and a moonshine lover. Come on, baby, do a slow float. You're a good-looking riverboat. Ain't that sweet, that blindness good to me?
That's one of my favorite songs, by the way, even before you performed it beautifully, Livingston Taylor. Yeah. Did you know her?
I do. I did know Laura. And
who died quite young,
She died young. She died of ovarian cancer at the age of 40, in her 40s. And, heartbreaking. She was a contemporary of mine. And, that Eli and the 13th Confession album. Forget about it.
So that is on Blue Sky, is that correct?
That
I want to confirm
song
that.
Is on Blue Sky.
Now, obviously, your opponent in today's quiz was a little scared, as they say, of the competition, because he showed late, but he did decide to show. Let me introduce him. Elijah Wald, you can thank him, by the way, for the Coen Brothers film Inside Llewyn Davis. He wrote the book, or co-wrote the book, we should say, The Mayor of McDougal Street, along with a great musician who I saw many years ago in Philadelphia, Dave Von Ronk. Mm. That's the book on which Llewyn Davis is based. Elijah, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here. I'm glad I made it in.
I'm glad you made it in, too.
Tell
people who haven't seen Inside Llewyn Davis and about the actual character that it was based on, Merchant Seaman, the whole deal.
Actually the most important thing is to tell people who have seen Llewyn Davis that the character was in no way based on Dave Van Ronk.
Okay.
That happened to the character are based on Dave. But the character's kind of this dark loser. And Dave was so much the opposite of that. He was one of the funniest, smartest men on the planet Earth.
And had great success.
And had great success for a moment and then had a lot of years of just dragging himself from club to club, but really kept his sense of humor about it, which is why he wrote the book he wrote, which is why the Coen brothers picked it up, because it's a really funny goddamn book.
Do you, well, do you and Livingston Taylor, do you know each other?
We have not met, though.
You
I have
not
certainly
met?
Seen
I,
you.
Obviously, I know of you. And
obviously, vice versa. I remember actually seeing you playing the Pete Seeger arrangement of the Beethoven thing on banjo.
Babadoo, babadoo, babadoo.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, to joy. Yes.
Yeah. Why did Von Ron, by the way, why he was in the era of the Dylans and the Joni Mitchell, two of the great songwriters of all time. Why did he not rise to the level of celebrity that some of his contemporaries
did? Oh, there are millions of reasons.
Well, give me one.
One of them is he wasn't really a songwriter. You know, that turned into a singer-songwriter world. And both of those people were very close friends of his. And he did write some songs, but that really wasn't his thing. He was an interpreter.
Yeah.
And he was an interpreter with a rough voice. And, you know, Dylan was supposed to be somebody who wasn't going to be able to make it either because he had a weird voice. But
Jewish kid from Minnesota.
But also there's a point here that's important.
What?
It's hard to be that front person. It's hard to be successful. When compared with my brother James all the time, which
brother?
I am regularly, and listen, my brother James is a wonderful man, and he's got a great career. Livingston Taylor has a great career. And the fact of the matter is that it's hard to be James Taylor. It's hard to be Madonna. It's hard to be Bob Dylan. And to assume that Bob Dylan's career is better than Dave Van Ronk's I just think it's delusional.
When you say it's hard, you mean because of the people chasing you or the having to maintain that level? Or what do you mean?
In many different ways. I can tell you celebrity and grand celebrity is straining and painful has been my observation. It is restrictive.
I gotta say, Van Ronk's immediate response would be maybe so, but it's real painful to not be able to pay your rent, which was true for most of the 70s and 80s for him.
Well,
He would have been very, very happy to have Bob Dylan's bank account,
if not his
career.
Again, the bank account, perhaps, yeah. But the fact of the matter is that it's a high price.
Yeah. Well, you've had a great career, too.
I am very delighted with the way the stars
Can I interrupt
aligned.
Here for a second?
Yes.
Now, you have a guitar in your lap as well.
Strangely
you
enough.
You do. And even though there is going to be a quiz in a couple of minutes, since we heard a little bit from Liv Taylor a couple of minutes ago, could you treat us to something?
Sure.
A couple of minutes worth? Elijah
sure.
Wald, please.
Something thin from Mississippi John Hurt. Please don't let my good girl catch you here. Yeah, just don't let my good girl catch you here. Cause she might shoot you, might cut and stab you too. There ain't no telling what she might do. And I'm up the country in the cold, sleet and snow. I'm up the country in the cold, sleet and snow. Yeah, I'm up the country in that cold, sleet, and snow. Ain't telling how much further I may go. I'll eat my breakfast here, my dinner in Tennessee. Eat my breakfast here, dinner in Tennessee. Yeah, I eat my breakfast here, eat my dinner in Tennessee. I told you I was coming, baby, why don't you look for me? Satisfied if I could just catch a train and ride. now if I reach Atlanta? Got nowhere to go. Oh, you make me down a pallet on the floor. Say, baby, make me down a pallet on your floor. Yeah, make me down a pallet on the floor. Make it soft, make it low, my good girl. She'll never know you made me a pallet on the floor.
Concert here, Jim. This is unbelievable.
This is big time. Okay,
yes,
you know what we're going to do?
Fantastic. That was great.
Came here to compete. You're going to compete whether you like it or not, even though maybe briefly.
Maybe very briefly. Yeah, I think we're going to have time for one question.
Why don't you ask? Oh, you got to put your headphones on, gentlemen, because you can hear the clues. And then maybe you'll play a little more before we send people home.
I think I'm starting with this organ thing. Is that correct?
You are starting with the, it's a Sarah Palin thing. Do you have that?
Okay.
Why don't you ask Elijah a question? I'll ask Liv.
Okay, ready, Elijah? Here's the question. Here is a newscast, as I just said, out of Oregon.
No, that would not be it.
That's not it?
No. Here is Sarah Palin's assessment. Do you have that page?
I'm on the wrong page. Okay, hold on.
Here is the first page. Just hand
Go
it
ahead.
Back to me. No, why don't you do that?
Okay. Sorry. Here is Sarah Palin's assessment of a geopolitical situation.
People are looking at Putin as one who wrestles bears and drills for oil. They look at our president as one who wears mom jeans and equivocates and bloviates.
Okay. So the operative phrase in that clip is, where's mom jeans? Earlier this week, President Obama clued us in on where he buys his mom jeans. Do you happen to know what store he did drop in on?
God, I feel like I'm in the old quiz show scandal thing where I'm not supposed to have been clued in, and yet I've had a hint. I'm going to go with The Gap.
You are correct.
Judges
it
say
is
that's correct.
The Gap.
Wait a second. Who clued you in? What is this? This is a straight up quiz show. What's the deal? We'll be investigated by the appropriate authorities. That's fine.
I would hope.
He's reading the newspapers.
Now, Livingston Taylor, you are trailing at the end of one half of a round. Yeah, is that daunting or not?
It is a mild concern. But,
okay, fine.
We will.
Here's your question, Liv. Here's Conan O'Brien, a Brookline boy, by the way, weighing in on some international news. Here it is.
Yes. Over the weekend, held elections and was reelected with 100% of the vote. 100% of the vote, yeah. Credits this win to his slogan, vote for me or you will be murdered.
What was the slogan? Now, who was reelected by apparently 100% of the vote? Do you know Liv Taylor?
My suspect is the leader of North Korea is the answer.
That is the correct answer. Congratulations. We are tied at the end of round one, which is the way it really should be.
Okay.
Do you have the next
am
page?
Am I on the right page now? It starts with Oregon?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Elijah,
I googled that
two.
Last one. I'm a little disorganized.
Did someone
here
tip you off to this one too, Elijah, or no?
Oregon isn't yet enough of a clue. I can't tell you.
He's paying attention. That's
oh,
what
he
you
is.
Want,
I
right?
Hate when
the
they
news
do
quiz.
That.
Okay. Here is a newscast out of Oregon.
And we aren't safe around the. We're trapped in our bedroom. He won't let us out of our door.
It is not your typical call to 911. A went on the attack against the very people who take care of it. Portland family made that call so afraid of their they needed police to rescue them.
This is a hard one.
Oh, it is a hard one.
Yes, okay. Devastatingly difficult.
Do you know, Elijah, what attacked this family?
I must admit I don't.
Now, the question is, can Liv Taylor steal the question? You're up on all things like this, Livingston Taylor. Do you know what the answer is?
All this is telling our listeners is that I have way too much time on my
You
hands.
Actually know the answer to
this? I do know the answer.
What's the answer?
It was a large cat.
A large cat?
That is frightening.
I've forgotten the name, the
Himalayan cat.
Himalayan,
it wasn't that large. It was 22 pounds.
What do you mean it's not that large?
Well, that's a good-sized cat, but it's not like it's a mountain lion or anything. It's 22
pounds. But 22 pounds in a bad mood is just... No, okay. No fun.
How do you know that, by the way?
I watch television.
Oh, you
and,
do?
And I read. I've got still got AOL on my email.
You do
I'm
not.
Holding
Is that
on.
True?
Yes, I do.
You have dial-up?
I don't have dial-up, but I have AOL, and I'm holding on to it until it goes retro.
Okay, I want to ask you a question then, since you know all these things. What happened to the cat? Did they have to have taken it down to the vet and have it euthanized? It probably did.
I thought, my understanding is that took it down to the, they captured it with a loop, they put it in a box, and I haven't heard that it's been euthanized, but it might have just been...
Drugged.
Drugged.
Maybe they gave it some drugs.
I don't know.
Okay, now here's the deal. Livingston Teller, you can really plunge into a huge lead here since you stole that question. Here's the Tonight... What's that again?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm ready. I'm just blabbing.
We'll see
here.
If you're ready.
Yeah.
Here's the Tonight Show's Jimmy Fallon on a headline from earlier this week. Listen.
Went on Twitter to remind his followers about daylight savings time, but accidentally, he told people to turn their clocks back instead of forward. Look at this tweet. That's his real tweet. There it is. Turn your clocks back and change the batteries and smoke. Yeah. And he's been tweeting a lot of incorrect information. Yeah. Look at this tweet here. Give a hoot, leave your plastic bottles on the ground for forest animals to enjoy. At least be thoughtful.
Now, this is a true. This actually happened. Who advised his constituents to turn their clocks back instead of forward, Livingston Teller?
I think it was like. Was it Kanye West?
No.
It was one of these, and the answer is that I don't know. I know of the incident, but I don't recall who it was.
I will give you a hint, Elijah. Well, this guy is often confused for Kanye West. Does that help at all?
I have to know whether that's a legit.
It's not legit, actually.
I figured it wasn't legit. No. I'm going to go with turn your clocks back as the clue and try Rush Limbaugh.
That's actually excellent. We should give him points for that, but it is wrong.
Yeah.
It is, of course, the illustrious mayor of Toronto. That would be Rob Ford. Now, how are we going to handle this? We only have a couple of minutes left.
I don't know. Do you want to go immediately to the
bonus
round?
Ask another question, Elijah, see if you can draw closer,
okay,
and then one of these gentlemen will play us out of the show.
Okay. What's this news report talking about?
What once was an innocent snack has now sparked an international food fight. The EU is proclaiming that it has exclusive rights to using certain names like or because those types of came from their turf. But the Europeans say that the American versions of their cut into their sales. And while some might think the situation has gotten out of hand, those in the biz say this isn't just something to laugh about.
Non, mais cette question, c'est absolument pour moi.
Oh!
Pas de problème du tout.
What do you think you are, John
no
Kerry?
Problem
What's
at
going
all.
On here?
Oh,
that was, yeah.
Yeah, no. This one I'm all over because I got my French passport last year.
Oh.
No. The goddamn Americans keep trying to claim that they can make our cheese in their filthy country.
Can
and
you
there's
say it
no
in French,
way.
Please?
Oui, les futurs Américains disent qu'ils peuvent faire des fromages, les
nôtres
fromages chez eux. Non, mais ça
but
va pas.
That
yeah.
was beautiful. You speak beautifully.
Good. You know, you could
it's
be
like,
a quiz show host. You know that Livingston Teller?
I
mean
indeed.
That as a compliment. Could
All
you
right.
not do that?
I,
you would be so incredibly
good. And you and Marjorie's
good.
Skill set, I can't imagine.
I got
oh,
it.
Wow. But, the skills, I don't know, that might be debatable, Livingston,
now,
actually.
In light of the fact that Elijah came late, even though he's glad we came, we're going to have to do a shortened version of our quiz. And would you mind, well, I'm asking Elijah a question. Would you mind picking up your guitar and playing us out of the show,
sure,
Livingston Teller? Elijah, what are you working on that we should know about?
God help me, I'm in grad school doing my dissertation on New Mexico music.
You are?
Currently preparing a talk on Jelly Roll Morton, but also another project, which actually I need to ask Liv Taylor about after this, is I'm trying to hunt up people who were at Newport in 1965 at the folk festival.
Wow.
So if any of you listeners out there have stories... I'm easy to find, Elijah@ElijahWalt.com.
That was my next question, how to find you, and now we know.
May I ask you a quick question? I saw Llewyn Davis, loved the movie, but I was frustrated because I wanted this kid to get a break, and it drove me crazy that there was no break ever. You know what I mean? What did you make
it was only 1 week out of his life.
Okay.
I mean, he'd had a break, he'd had a couple of albums already, and who knows what happened next week.
Okay, I guess that's the optimistic way to do it. I wanted him to...
I wanted it to end differently than getting beat up in an alleyway. You know what I mean?
Now, Livingston Taylor, you're performing all over the place in March, April, and May. Your new CD, Blue Sky, comes out in April. That's at livtaylor.com. Is that what that thing
is? Livtaylor.com.
Okay,
that's
sorry.
No, that's my website, livtaylor.com.
Yeah.
And that knows all about me. That's where I go for information about what the heck I'm supposed to be doing.
Now, by the way, Liv Taylor is kind enough to play us out of the show. We should say Martha Coakley, the Attorney General, who's running for governor, she will join us on Monday. And here is Livingston Taylor. Is this another tune from Blue Sky?
No, it's not.
Perfect.
It's just me, just playing a song. It says, ha, 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 ho, 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 and a couple of fa-la-las. That's how we laugh the day away in the merry old land of Oz. Rub, rub here, rub, rub there, whether you're tin or bronze, that's how we keep you in repair in the merry old land of Oz. We get up at 12 and start to work at 1. Take an hour for lunch, then at 2 we're done. Jolly good fun.
See you Monday.